Ecclesiastes chapter 1. What makes life meaningful? Where do people find meaning for their life? That's the question that Solomon asks in Ecclesiastes. And he gives a sudden, jarring answer. Nothing in this life gives meaning. Family, work, career, money, recreation, hobbies, home, none of these things and nothing else in this world gives meaning. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. That's the message of Ecclesiastes in part. Nothing in this world gives ultimate meaning. As we begin this study in this book, my goal is not to go verse by verse through the book, nor to answer some of the specific difficulties of understanding. There's certain verses in here particularly that are challenging. That's not my point. I did that last summer, in fact. And what I'm going to do here in the next 8 weeks is what I had intended to do as tagged on or as a part of the study we did last summer, and I decided to go back and to it later and do it together as a congregation in the morning service. And so what I intend to do is to give you the big picture, to help you tie together the major themes of this book, to help you see better the realities of our life, and really especially to see the only reasonable answer for how we ought to live life. Now, if you're familiar with Ecclesiastes or if you went through the study in the afternoon service last summer, you know that it is challenging at times. And part of what makes Ecclesiastes challenging is the arrangement of its arguments. It does not progress smoothly from one point to the next, to the next, to the next. Solomon is certainly not a Western thinker. We think typically point one, point two, point three, point four. We have an introduction, we have a conclusion, we have a major thesis. If you were taught it, were given any kind of a writing course, it's probably the basic ideas you were taught. You lay out your arguments, you put your weakest ones in the middle where hopefully they won't notice how weak they are. You end with your strongest point to really bolster your conclusion. Solomon really doesn't do that. He certainly ends with his conclusion, but what he does is he swerves around and around. I can't even say he goes in spiral fashion. Rather, he starts here with verse 2, and if you will, his conclusion is here, and he goes and he almost gets to his conclusion, and he swerves back out here, and then he does a couple loop-de-loops, and then he gets to his conclusion. And repeating and retouching on various points along the way, at times seems like in no particular order. But I will say, as you read the book, he is actually moving steadily toward his conclusion. So if you will, if you imagine Ecclesiastes as a mountain, we are here at the bottom of the mountain, and there's a very windy road that takes us up there, but when it gets there, you're at the peak. And everything is moving steadily towards that point. Every additional point he adds, it includes in the book, just adds to the weight of his argument. So by the time you reach the end of the book, you are ready for the conclusion that he gives. And basically what Solomon does is repeatedly show the limitations of the human life. For over 12 chapters, I would say for every verse but two, he's basically saying these are the limitations of human life so that we can see the great value of living for God. Now, there are a lot of different perspectives on Ecclesiastes. Many consider this book to be written from a nearly godless perspective. He uses the phrase under the sun a lot. And so according to them, Ecclesiastes, or a large portion of Ecclesiastes, is a focus on life on earth from the perspective of those of us owners. And I disagree. It's not my perspective at all. It's not the perspective I'm going to take as we go through this. This book shows us the poverty of living life on earth from the purely earthly perspective. Solomon's not trying to figure it out from an earthly perspective. He is proving. He is saying, look, here's the evidences that this way doesn't work. So if you will, it's not as much an experiment in the sense of I'm trying, but he's saying this flat doesn't work. Let me prove it to you. Here's why it doesn't work. And he's using his own life as proof. You see, he's done this. And now he's writing and saying this doesn't work. He sets out from the very first chapter on a single-minded mission to prove the folly of seeking satisfaction, meaning, and fulfillment in this life. He sets out, verse 3, to answer the question, what profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? That's the question of Ecclesiastes. He actually gives us the answer first and then gives us the question. In other words, what do we gain by all of our work in this world? Does life have any point? Does it matter how you live? He's asking the question, does your life matter? At the age of 20, King Solomon took the throne of Israel following the death of his father David. And David was the greatest king of Israel. Historically, the greatest ever. Certainly, at the time of Solomon's reign, he was the greatest. He was the second. But David's kingship was incredible. He was a man beloved of God and loved by his people. He had accomplished what no leader of Israel had ever accomplished. Hundreds of years in the land, David was the one that finally secured the land of Canaan. David was the one that pushed the enemies out and finally brought peace to the nation. Solomon had big shoes to fill. And so when Solomon took the throne, God gave him a great gift. God spoke to Solomon and told him that he would give Solomon whatever he desired. And so Solomon asked for wisdom to rule the Israelites well. God answered that request. 1 Kings chapter 4 tells us that God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much and largeness of heart, even as the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country, and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men. God gave to Solomon the greatest wisdom. And in the early years of his reign, Solomon used that wisdom and he did great things. He expanded the kingdom. He built beautiful palaces for himself. He built the temple for God. I would argue the greatest temple that the world has ever seen. But Solomon, later in his life, turned from wisdom to folly. He began to marry many wives. In the end, he had 300 wives, a harem of 700 additional women. And his wives turned his heart away from the Lord. So that Solomon began to build temples to the false gods that his wives worshipped, including the temple to Molech, where the Israelites would later throw their babies into the fire as an offering to that false god. And the book of Ecclesiastes, I believe, was written at the end of Solomon's life, after his long folly. I believe it is an expression of both repentance and a warning to those who might follow in his footsteps. So I would argue that Solomon was a believer who fell into sin, but he never ultimately abandoned his faith in God. So that Ecclesiastes reflects that faith as Solomon reflects on his folly. And Solomon is writing from a very biblical perspective. He's building his case on the knowledge of both creation, that we are created by God, and the fall, that man rebelled against sin, against God, and the world is cursed because of sin. Solomon builds his case upon a familiarity with divine authority. He recognizes that God is to be worshipped. Ecclesiastes is not a godless book. Its most important considerations show a clear understanding of God and man's obligation to God. Certainly, it includes, and here we're going to see in chapters 1 and 2, the record of Solomon's extravagant attempts to find fulfillment in earthly pleasures and the failure of those things. And having everything, Solomon discovered he had nothing. And Ecclesiastes shows to us the frustration and emptiness of a life lived for this world. But I want to be careful. As much as I say, it shows us that frustration and emptiness. Solomon does not say that life has no meaning. We need to not go that far. Now, there's one author I've read, a secular author, that said that this is the most depressing book in the Bible, full of nothing but death and funerals. I couldn't disagree more strongly. The message of Ecclesiastes, in fact, there's some translations that interpret verse 2 as meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless, completely meaningless. Another says absolute futility, absolute futility. Everything is futile. That's not what Solomon's saying. I think we miss the point if we go to this book, and even in as strong as the opening words are, and say everything is meaningless. Solomon is not saying everything is meaningless. Solomon is saying a life lived looking for satisfaction in this life is doomed to disappointment. It is going to be frustrating. It is going to be empty. It's going to be unsatisfying. But it is not meaningless. And when we understand Ecclesiastes and what it offers, it's not a depressing book. It is one filled with hope and joy and encouragement. It is a brilliant piece of writing. It has been called the most contemporary book in the Bible. It's been said that in Ecclesiastes, the unsaved man is given an astoundingly clear description of what he will find in this world and in his life, which should drive him to seek God. That's the value of this book. That's one of the reasons that this book is so worthwhile for us to study, because in Ecclesiastes, it gives us a realistic picture of our lives and this world. It undercuts all of our attempts and all of the world's attempts to find ultimate meaning in the here and now and the things that we have or do. Ecclesiastes teaches us to view this world and our life rightly so that we may seek God. Because as long as we live in this world thinking that it will provide us with that ultimate satisfaction, we are going to bounce from one pleasure to the next, always expecting the next thing to be just what we need. I mean, really, is that not modern advertising? This is what you need? Do we not see this in our own lives? Even those of us who are saved, we look around and we say, I need this iPhone. I need this this car. I need this boat. I need this four-wheeler. I need this house. I need it. And we get it, and it's great for a little while, and then it's not so great anymore. If only I had a view of the lake, everything would be wonderful. Then we get the tax bill. Or if only I had whatever the latest smartphone is, I'd be happy for a little while. You know, if only I had more free time. And we go from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, because there's an endless supply of promises. There's an endless number of gadgets and toys and things that we can chase after. And we can go without ever stopping to pause and reflect. We can go from one to the next to the next to the next. And what Solomon says very, very abruptly says it's all vanity. Stop. Stop. Quit chasing after everything. Because nothing is going to provide lasting satisfaction. And he proves it. Look in verse 4. And he goes down, he says, one generation passeth away, another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also rises, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. This world continues on through its endless cycles. This generation is here, it's going to be gone in just a little while. Another generation is going to spring up, and seemingly the world will not even notice. Sun rose this morning, it's going to go down this evening, it's going to rise again tomorrow, it's going to go down again tomorrow night, it's just going to keep spinning. The rivers are going to run into the sea, the sea's not going to be full. It's not come a point where the seas overflow the land. Rather, the waters are going to return into the sky, fall back down again as rain, and it keep happening. This cycle. Over and over and over again. He says down in verse 8, all things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear with hearing. So everything is full of labor. Man's life is full of labor, but labor never fills man. It's unsatisfying. Let me take the eye. We look and we see every day. Countless numbers of things. Over the course of our lives, the things that we have seen, and yet our eye never fills up and never gets stopped and says, I can't see any more images, can't take in any more, that's it. Our ear hears noises, sounds, music, and words, and yet it never gets full, it never gets clogged up from all that sound. It's never filled. The thing which hath been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new. It hath been already of old time which was before us. Things just keep happening the same way. Now, I do need to make a quick comment on this verse. Because some have taken these verses and said, well, see, everything we have now they have had before. Solomon's not saying that in some ancient time they had computer technology, because we have it now. There's nothing new under the sun. They must have had some sort of computers back, I don't know, before the flood, maybe. He's speaking particularly of the ambitions, the devices of men, the work of men. We're doing the same things that we've been doing all throughout man's history. We might have new technology, we might have new gadgets, there might be new ways of doing things, but it's all the same old thing. It's all that endless striving for satisfaction, meaning, and happiness. It's all of that where we can't go and say, I mean, we can say here's a new mousetrap, but we're still trying to catch mice. That's what he's saying. It's the same and just keeps going round and round. Verse 11, there's no remembrance of former things. Neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that come after. Why isn't it satisfying? Why isn't there any real ultimate meaning in it? Because what we do, it's going to be forgotten. We see this in our culture. We talk about, you know, we go up and interview people on the street, ask them to name 5-10 presidents. How many can do that? Tell us, you know, what was the War of 1812 fought over? Who was the 13th president of the United States? What did he do? I mean, we go on an endless list of questions just from the couple hundred years of American history that we have forgotten. I talk about Michael Jordan, the greatest basketball player ever, in my opinion. Most people here are old enough to, if you followed basketball, you know what I'm talking about. I talk to younger people, and who? Really? You don't know who Michael Jordan is? How could you not know such an important piece of history? Do you know there was a time where he dominated culture? Absolutely dominated it so that his symbol was recognized around the world. 20, 25 years later, the next generation doesn't know who he is. We could multiply examples of that. From things as trivial as sports and movies to serious things like philosophy and culture, politics. But just don't remember. So Solomon goes on, chapter 2. He puts this to the ultimate test. He said, I said in my heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity. He said, I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? Solomon put this to the ultimate test. More than anyone else, Solomon was able to search the pleasures of life for satisfaction and for meaning. And he tried it all. Everything that you could try, he did it. We would say something along the lines of Solomon lived the life of a rock star. He had every pleasure. So that he says in verse 10, whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy. He tried everything. If he wanted it, he had it. He was one of the richest kings ever. He had the respect and the fame and the power of that kingdom. He was able to take its resources and spend it upon whatever extravagance he wanted. So he said in verse 3 that he gave his heart to wine. In verse 4, I had great works, houses and vineyards. In verse 5, gardens and orchards and trees and all kinds of fruit. Verse 6, he made pools of water to water the trees with. He had a house full of servants and maidens. He had possessions of all of the wealth of the world, of all great and small cattle. I gathered me also silver and gold. And the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. Solomon was a wealthy man who heaped to himself riches and lands. He had singers, men singers and women singers, the delights of the son and the sons of men. He had everything that he could desire. It was all his for the taking, and he took it. So we go to the book of Ecclesiastes, and I think this is one of the reasons that Solomon's writing here is so powerful. Solomon is not writing at the end of a long life of having lived as a hermit in a cave and saying all of those things in life don't have any real ultimate meaning. Because, I mean, people say, you've heard, you know, money can't buy happiness. I'd like to try anyway. Solomon has said, I tried it. I tried it. Listen to me. Pay attention here so you don't make the same mistake. I tried it. Verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hand had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. His question is, what profit hath a man of all of his labor which he taketh under the sun? There is no profit in all of the pleasures and the works that man can do on this earth. That is the stark reality of Ecclesiastes. He starts off this book saying, frustrating and fleeting. Everything is temporary. The world offers nothing that lasts, nothing that remains, nothing that brings satisfaction or fulfillment. Again, life is not meaningless, but it does not provide ultimate meaning. It cannot provide ultimate meaning. This is the seductive lie of the self-identity movement. It's sweeping America right now. I can identify myself as anything. I'm a starfish. I self-identify as a starfish. That makes me happy and fulfilled. The lie is, if I can define myself and be true to myself and accomplish my dreams, how I formulate them in my own heart, then I will have meaning. No, you can't. No, you don't. Your life is temporary. Your identity is temporary. Your dreams are temporary. None of it. None of it brings satisfaction. Let me talk about just one example. Solomon lists here. Possessions. All of that stuff we have. All that we work for. He talks about this at the end of chapter 2. It's going to be given to somebody else. When you die, or maybe before you die. All of these things that you've labored for are going to be given over to another. And the odds are, they're not going to appreciate it, the value it has to you, and the work you put into it. I know of a family, had a grandfather that kept everything. He had a barn full of stuff he collected over the years. As he was getting older, the grandkids decided that they really didn't want to sort through all of his junk after death. So they burnt the barn down with everything in it. I know that's an extreme example, but what happens to your stuff? If you're trying to find meaning in the things of this life, in the things you own, if you're trying to find some sort of lasting significance of it, you're going to be disappointed. And I could go on and on. I don't want to end up depressing us entirely here. But we could walk through every one of these things Solomon mentions. And this is why I understand why some look at this book and say it's pessimistic. I understand. I mean, these first two chapters, especially, you look at it and say, boy, this is depressing. What is he saying? What's the point? Because even wisdom, Solomon says, it was just frustrating. Because the more you understand the world, the more you see how badly broken it is. But that's not the point. The point is not to say, look, everything's miserable, it stinks. Why bother? If that's all we get out of Ecclesiastes, we've completely missed the boat. The point is, stop looking for lasting significance in this world. When we do that, we can then rightly enjoy the things of this world. They can bring us genuine pleasure. Solomon says over and over and again in this book to go out and enjoy life. And there are a number who have said, well, he's just being cynical, sarcastic, saying there's no point in anything, so you better enjoy it while you can. No, Solomon is saying these things cannot provide ultimate meaning. But when you realize where satisfaction is found, you can rightly and genuinely enjoy the things of this life. Because you're not expecting them to do something they cannot possibly do. You can expect them to do what they were given to us to do. And the answer, in part, is in chapter 3. Turn over there. Ecclesiastes 3, verse 11. The reason that nothing satisfies, the reason that life is frustrating, is that God has created us for something more. It says, He hath made everything beautiful in His time. Also, He has set the world in their heart. I'm going to stop right there in that verse. If you have something other than the King James in front of you, probably says something along the lines of He has set eternity in their heart. I like that way of expressing it, because it's what Solomon is saying, is that God has created us as eternal beings. We are not designed to live in a fallen, broken, temporary world. And we realize this. May not always be able to say it. It's not like we're going to go out in the street and talk to somebody who can say, boy, you know, I've really been suffering this week because I just realized I'm not designed to live in this world. We know most people don't say it like this. But we are looking for meaning, and we know there must be something more. We know there must be some sort of something beyond this. Because God has put this in our hearts. He has given us this eternal within us. And this desire for the eternal cannot be filled by possessions or wealth or sex or power or wisdom or work or any other earthly thing. All of these things are temporary. It is impossible to satisfy an eternal longing with temporary things. The eternal can only be satisfied by the eternal. The answer to this longing is God. The answer to this longing is that relationship with Him. But Ecclesiastes, in part, is showing us, and it's giving us a compelling illustration of how sin has damaged that relationship with Him. And even though Christ is not explicitly stated in this book, if we understand what the book teaches us, the only response is to run to Christ. Because that's the only answer. We look at this book and we recognize that these things cannot satisfy. The only answer is God. If my relationship with God has been damaged, what's my hope? If I can't have a relationship with God, this book is incredibly pessimistic. But because we can have a relationship with God, because Christ died on the cross, He suffered the penalty of our sin, because Christ extends forgiveness to us, we can have a restored relationship with God. We can have what the psalmist says are pleasures forevermore that are found at His right hand. We can have that joy unspeakable. Joy beyond description in that relationship with God that is ours through Christ. And the first thing we have to address as we're thinking about Ecclesiastes is, do you know Him? Is He your God and Savior? Is He your satisfaction? Because even for those of us who are saved, as Christians, we tend at times to look elsewhere. We still tend to fall into that same trap of saying, if I had, do, am this, then I'll have meaning, significance, satisfaction, fulfillment. And that's not true. They can't provide that. Oh, it's only found in God. The answer is to turn from seeking our satisfaction in things in life and success and power, riches, pleasures, all of it. To acknowledge we are broken, corrupted by sin. As Christians, it is to run to Him and to say, I'm trusting, I'm enjoying You and only You. I'm finding my satisfaction in You. I'm looking to these other things. They're great pleasures. The house on the lake is wonderful. When you can look out and you can say, thank God, He has given me these precious things that I can enjoy to His glory. The new phone, probably still frustrating, but it can be a good thing. When you say, this is a gift of God that He has given me, and I can enjoy Him, even through something as silly, ultimately as a Samsung. When I recognize that my satisfaction is in Him, we can enjoy these things in their proper place, but not expecting too much of them. So ultimately, what Ecclesiastes tells us is seek first the kingdom of God. And I want to challenge you as believers, let that focus shape your life so that you're very intentionally examining your view of the things around us to keep them in their proper place. Not denying their goodness, but not elevating them to be more than they are, but rather instead making God your satisfaction.